From Texas Public Radio, this is Texas Matters, a weekly radio news magazine that looks at the issues, events, and people in the Lone Star State. Today on Texas Matters, Native Texan stories from deep in the heart. This is Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Earlier this week, I hosted a TPR public event and was in conversation with author Joe Hawley. He is known for his popular Native Texan column with the Houston Chronicle, where he writes about the character of Texas and the characters contained in Texas. A selection of the columns have been collected into a new book called Native Texan, Stories from Deep in the Heart. It's published by Trinity University Press. Here's our conversation. Joe Hawley, it's so great to have you here today to talk about your book and your stories and your travels and pulling it all together for us in this new book. The idea of a Native Texan and this collection of stories, and these are the kind of stories that seem to be the long chain molecules that make up Texas identity. Can you talk about how these stories, you know, you're part of your column work at the Houston Chronicle, but then again, you went through and you selected these. Can you talk about that process?
Well, I am a Native Texan. I'm from Waco. Dave and I were talking earlier about how I wrote speeches for Ann Richards, and since both of us were from Waco, I had grown up hearing that Waco twang. So it was fairly easy to write speeches for Ann Richards, and I was telling Dave that when I wrote for her, I thought I was the greatest speech writer in the world. And then when she was defeated and I wrote for other people, I realized I was not the greatest speech writer in the world. But I have been intrigued my whole life by this place where we all live, by the people. You know, strange and interesting people. I was at the Washington Post, and when I was there, I taught a class at George Washington University, and I told one of my students that my unofficial beat was to write about eccentric Texans. And she said, "Mr. Hawley, you sure must be busy." And she's right. But when I get out and about the state, small towns, even small communities within a place like San Antonio, I'm looking for people who have stories to tell. I'm looking for the personality of a place. And I'm looking for something about the past that has shaped the place and those particular people I'm talking to.
Can you talk about how you used to go out with your dad on his potato chip route in Waco and how that kind of started all that?
So we lived in Waco. My dad sold potato chips within, say, a 50-mile radius of Waco. Beginning, I think, when I was five or so, I would go with him during the summers and at Christmas holidays. And I think early on for the company that I would provide for him as he drove around to towns like Temple and Belton and Killeen and Rosebud and Cameron. I can tell you each stop every day. It would be a different set of towns every day of the week. But then as I got older, I became somebody who would really help him. And I began to notice that towns had personalities, and it was intriguing to me. You know, I would try to imagine, here I lived in Waco, I would try to imagine what it would be like living in Temple and what the differences were. And I still find that interesting. I'm curious about how people put together a community. My wife, Laura, and I have a little house way out in West Texas called Marathon, not Marathon. So you all keep that in mind. It's Marathon, Dave. And it's a small town, maybe 400 people. And it's really interesting to watch this old town sort of being reborn with newcomers coming in, appreciating the past, but building something new and interesting in this little dried up West Texas town.
There are some small towns in Texas that I've kind of like mentally adopted. that I kind of like keep an eye on them.
And have you been there? Or you just
I've covered stories there, and it seemed like this is like Premont, which is in Jim Wells County, just south of Alice and north of Falfurrias, and it's one of these small towns that it seems like it's just always something weird going on there. Palestine, Texas, is another place where something horrible is always happening there.
And so that's what you're drawn to.
Yeah, my journalism. So do you have like some of these towns that just sort of like stick with you?
Well, they stick with me for more positive reasons. There are towns like Marathon that I just mentioned that are still alive, because when I'm driving around the state, you all have had this experience too. You're driving around Texas and you come into small towns and they are dried up and they're blowing away. They're lucky if they have a courthouse to inject a little life into these places. But otherwise, you know, it's the courthouse square and either abandoned buildings or the building that used to be the downtown drugstore or furniture store or whatever might be an antique store or a junk store, and there's not really a difference in these little places. So when I come upon a town that is a little town.
Sort of a Larry McMurtry Last Picture Show.
Oh, absolutely, yeah, the wind blowing, the bus coming along to take you to the Korean War and all that. But when I find a town that has managed to avoid that dire fate, then I'm interested in how did this happen? A little town in the panhandle called Canadian is one of them. It's Canadian, for example, is so far north of Amarillo, that the nearest town of any size is Liberal, Kansas. And it's sort of hilly up there, despite what you think about the panhandle. It's a beautiful little place.
And that's where they took a hit with the Smokehouse Creek fire.
The fires, that's right, yeah. And Canadian survives because people of some means have stayed and rooted themselves in their hometown, and they've got money and they fix it up.
Keep it alive.
And, you know, I'm sure many of us drive across Texas. And I had a job when I was at UT between semesters trying to make some money. And it was a road construction job. You know, you go to the counties and you see how the county roads don't exactly match up. And so, well, the job was to try to make the county roads more sync up a little bit. So we would like pave like 8 feet of road, and then we'd drive across Texas to do the job someplace else.
They would follow fields, farm fields.
Yeah,
that's why they were.
And so I drove a lot across Texas to do a little bit of work, and I get paid for that. Mm-hmm. But you just see the incredible state that we have and the people there to see how, and you said this would be a great place to live if it wasn't here, you know, and all that.
Well, I have to share with you a similar experience, okay? My first real job, no, it was a summer job, actually, now that I think about it, but it was my first state job was working for the Texas Highway Department, and it was to walk along I-35 between Waco and the town of West, picking up trash and dead animals. In weather like this, outside. Yeah.
It made you want to study harder and learn how to write a little bit better?
My boss was a fellow named Rufus Cockrum, and he'd been doing it for about 20 years, and he had 12 years to go. And all he would talk about was what he was going to do when he retired. And then he'd say, Joe, go to school. Go to college.
So in your book, A Native Texan, you know, it's interesting, all the stories, these vignettes that you have about Texas, very personal for you in this book. There's a lot of there's threads that come directly back to you. Was that deliberate?
The earlier book, Hometown Texas, that Trinity published, it's a beautiful book because it has photos by a Rice University photographer named Peter Brown. And he divided the state into five different sections and would have West Texas photos, North Texas, and so forth. They weren't illustrating the columns, but they were his notion of what that part of the state looked like, felt like. And I was doing the same thing with the columns. This one, as I was picking out columns that I wanted to include in the book are a bit more personal. I just realized I was talking to Laura earlier. You know, after you've lived a certain amount of time, you become histories. It's like going into a museum and seeing an exhibit of mid-century modern furniture and realizing that's the couch I sat on watching that little TV.
Talk a bit like, you know, the connection to like Bonnie and Clyde that's in the book.
I'm not quite that old, but I will tell you about the connection. Imagine that it's 1931, I think, and there's this young man walking on a cold winter day through a field, and he's got a shotgun in his hand, and his little boy is following behind him several steps. And he has two shotgun shells, and he's looking for either rabbits or squirrels to shoot because it's the Depression, and they are poor, and they have nothing to eat. And he sees a couple of rabbits and misses. So he goes back home with his little boy. Oh, this fellow I'm telling you about is named Joe as well, Joe Holly, in fact. He was my uncle. And he goes back to the house with nothing to eat, but that night he sneaks out and finds a couple of chickens at a neighbor's farm. And the family eats, but he gets caught and spends 100 days in the Hill County Jail. This is an aside, but years later, when my daughter and I were looking through old Hill County records, she was looking through one of those big ledgers at trials and so forth, and she said, Dad, I didn't know you'd been in jail. And it was the other Joe Holly. But while the original Joe Holly was in jail in Hillsboro, his fellow inmate was a fellow named Raymond Hamilton, this 22-year-old kid who was in there for being involved in the murder of a jewelry store owner in Hillsboro. And the deputy sheriff of Hill County one morning led a school group upstairs to the cell where Joe and Raymond Hamilton were being held, sort of an early scared straight, I guess. But somehow Raymond Hamilton got the lowdown on the sheriff, took his gun, took the kids back downstairs as if he were leading the the tour, ran across the street, stole a car ran out of gas, and he got caught again. Raymond Hamilton ended up being executed a year or so later because of an escape that Bonnie and Clyde engineered. Anyway, the story goes on. His brother was also a driver for Bonnie and Clyde, Floyd Hamilton. And years later, I discovered that Floyd was living in West Dallas. And I went to see him and told him I wanted to interview him. And he said, well, I'll think about it. Come back in a week. And I went back in a week, and Floyd Hamilton said, I will never talk to a newspaper guy, a reporter, again. And he explained that a young Dallas Morning News reporter had come by in the meantime, and he was telling her about how hard life was in Alcatraz, where he was held for years. And he told her that he got gum disease, pyorrhea. She heard a word that rhymes with pyorrhea, and that's what the Morning News read and it wrote, and it irritated Mr. Hamilton. So I didn't get he didn't talk to me, and I didn't get the story. Sorry, guys.
Yeah, it's kind of hard to follow up on that. I know. You know,
here's one quick way to follow up. That little boy who was following my Uncle Joe through the woods that morning, within 10 years, had become a Navy pilot flying over the Pacific in World War II. And was shot down exactly like George Bush was shot down. And as he's in the water in the Pacific, there's an American Navy destroyer coming to rescue him, and there's a Japanese submarine coming to get him. And the Americans rescued him. So these are Texas stories.
That gets to the idea of we have this Texas identity. It's very important to many of us. It's important to the state because you know, for marketing reasons, right. The Texas identity has become a commodity in many ways. Mm-hmm. You travel around the world and you tell people you're from Texas, and mm-hmm. they immediately, you know, an eyebrow might shoot up, and they expect something. And the Texas identity is fed by these types of stories, mm-hmm. stories of independent rascals who mm-hmm. will, you know, might find some chickens in the middle of the night to keep the family fed, people who, you know, challenge authority. But it's important now that as Texas is, you know, dealing with its diversity, that we have stories that also reflect that as well. And it seems like in your book, Native Texan, you are inclusive in your story selection. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I'm trying to be, because I realized that the Texas history that I learned in seventh grade, Texas history, you know, Crockett, Travis Bowie, and the icons, left out, I realized later, not in the seventh grade, left out a whole lot of Texans and a whole lot of great Texas stories, whether it's about women or African Americans or Hispanics or whoever. They're the stories that really need to be told, not only because they're interesting, but because they help us shape what this state really is, what it has been, and what it can be. And so I looked for stories, for example, like the one about Blas Payne, who was a black Seminole. That's how he described himself. And the black Seminole story is an amazing tale about these runaway slaves in Florida who got run out of Florida by Andrew Jackson, ended up in Oklahoma. They were afraid they were going to be enslaved in Indian territory, came through Texas into Mexico, came back to Texas to fight Indians with the U.S. Army, and their descendants still live out in West Texas. Blas Payne lived, you'll probably remember Texas Agriculture Secretary Susan Combs, who has a ranch out near Marathon, and Blas Payne worked for her family. And
he was a cowboy.
He was a cowboy, yeah, and... yeah, he was, and just a character. Everybody knew him, respected him, and he's buried on the side of a mountain out close to.
So how did you get to that gravesite?
The gravesite is on Susan Combs Ranch right off a road, and it's on the other side of a barbed wire fence, and I drive by that gravesite up on the hill several times a week when we're out there, and finally I was taking our dog Buddy to the park, and I decided to leave Buddy in the car, and I just sort of crawled under the barbed wire, hoping that Susan didn't have cameras out there and read his tombstone.
So is that part of the job requirement? You got to be able to crawl on your belly like a reptile to get through barbed wire fence,
yeah.
and to climb over fences to get into oldest graveyards in Houston.
It seems like graveyards. I remember climbing over a fence in on Houston's east side next to the ship channel, and this wasn't barbed wire. It was one of those. How do you describe it? These iron.
Wrought iron.
Yeah. Yeah, so I got up over the fence. I had one leg on one side, one leg on the other, and I could imagine the headlines in my paper, the Houston Chronicle. Elderly gentleman found pinioned on cemetery fence, or arrested, or whatever.
Okay. What were you doing there?
I was looking for the guy who I thought was buried there, but he wasn't.
But his tombstone was there.
a monument was there. It was the guy for whom Harris County is named. Do y'all know? I didn't. I was a Houstonian. I didn't know. I think it was Richard Harris, or is that the... Anyway, he's buried
in New Orleans. Not Kamala Harris. But so Harris was the person who founded Harrisburg.
Yeah, that's right.
Which became Houston.
That's right.
And so something gets. He came down with Moses Austin.
He came down, and he was a. He had boats that would run along the coast, I guess, from Houston to New Orleans, and then down toward Veracruz.
So why would the person that Harris County, the most populous county in the state, one of the most prosperous counties in the mm-hmm. state, why would his name become suddenly a not even a trivia question. People don't even know the answer.
Yeah, I know. And I asked a local historian that, and he said, well, he was just a little ahead of his time or something. I didn't quite know what that meant.
Well, he didn't live long enough to be in the Revolution.
He did not live long enough. Yeah, he wasn't a soldier or an Indian fighter or something of that sort.
So is part of your job is collecting stories that are almost winked out of existence? Do you just catch them just in time, pull them out of the mist, and bring them back into the light?
Yeah. That's what makes the job fun, because there's so many of them like that.
Where do you usually turn to find these things?
It has to do with having lived long enough that you know these stories, or you've heard these stories, or you've heard rumors of these stories, and you go check them out. And keep in mind that I'm a journalist, and one part of my beat is not necessarily eccentric Texans, but it is the past. It is history. I'm not a historian. I'm a journalist, and I go to places where I don't know the answer to these things. I want to know, and my notebook gives me license to be nosy and to ask questions. So it's things I vaguely know, or it's emails from people saying, hey, you ought to go to...
And because you're a journalist, you're dealing with facts. These are not folk tales.
No, they're not folk tales, and they're not where you can find the best barbecue in Brady or whatever.
And so I'm really kind of mystified by the story of how the Marx Brothers got their start in Nacogdoches, Texas, which is baffling because, the Marx Brothers are famously not from Texas.
They are not from Texas, for sure. You all realize that, right? Now, the Marx Brothers were on the burlesque circuit, and their mother, Minnie, was their manager. They would make sort of the circuit through the South into Texas, and Nacogdoches was a fairly sophisticated town in the early 1900s, and so they were appearing in Nacogdoches, and their act had to do with little musical numbers, maybe little stories and things, and they had a full crowd on this Saturday in their theater, which is still there, but the crowd was not responding, and Groucho, I'm not sure they were named Groucho, Harpo, and all that at that point, but Groucho was really getting perturbed, and suddenly the back doors open, and this fellow bursts in. He says, a mule is loose, and the whole crowd gets up and leaves. Groucho and friends or brothers are just enraged, and so gradually, the crowd filters back in. They got the mule corralled. He was rampaging down Main Street, but they finally got him caught. They come back in, and Groucho starts insulting the crowd. I can't remember.
The roaches of Nacogdoches.
Stuff like that. And his brothers were appalled because they were in Texas. And you know what happens to people who insult Texans. But to their shock and surprise, the audience is laughing hysterically. And that's when the Marx Brothers realized they were comedians.
So they went back to Brooklyn and put on the grease paint mustache and became the comedians. And we had to wait until the talkies came around. But right. But that was still part of the... Interesting how a mule in Nacogdoches provided and gave us the horse feathers of the Marx Brothers. So do you think Texas is unmined, for these gems? There's so many still out there.
It's a big place, and it's it's changing. And as we were discussing earlier, there are stories that we have ignored. So why not go find them?
Do you go to the barber, ask him, you know any good stories from around here? I mean, it seems like they're always a good...
Sometimes. Not necessarily a barber, but maybe Whataburger or something. Dairy Queen, just sit and listen and then introduce yourself.
And so in the collection, Native Texan, are you weaving together, I want to get back to this Texas identity thing, because I'm fascinated by it, because not only do we shape it, but it shapes us. Mm-hmm. And so are you, out of all the columns that you had to choose from, why these? What makes these ones stick out to you?
It's almost kind of a journalist mystical feel. You hear about something and you think, hey, that's a good story. Or you have lived or experienced something like your Uncle Joe getting thrown in jail with the Hamilton boy. You know, that's a story that I think people would be interested in hearing, even though it's my story, but I think it's worth sharing. I'm sort of drawn to the small towns because they're kind of self-contained and you can tell their stories easily as opposed to telling the story of San Antonio or Dallas or Houston. But once you get into San Antonio and find discrete communities and interesting people, I mean, those stories are worth telling as well.
And there's also parts of San Antonio that used to be very rural, parts of Houston that used
very
to be
much so,
and
right,
have been
right,
consumed by urban sprawl. These small mm-hmm. towns that used to exist or have been paved over.
Yeah, subsumed into big city.
I mean, didn't your mom come from a small town that used to be in outside of San Antonio?
It still is. My mom was the 1932 valedictorian of Bigfoot High School and a star volleyball player for the Bigfoot Cat Hounds.
Did you want to talk about Bigfoot a little bit more? Not the mystical creature, but the other Bigfoot, Bigfoot Wallace.
Yeah, Bigfoot Wallace is interesting because he is sort of the archetypal frontiersman. Did you know that when Disney was looking for a frontier hero in the early 50s, he came up with four candidates. One was Daniel Boone, one was Johnny Appleseed, one was Davy Crockett, one was Bigfoot Wallace. Bigfoot Wallace is interesting because he got here as a 19-year-old to avenge the death of a brother and a cousin at Goliad. And he hated Texas, and yet he stayed here from age 19 until he died in 1899, and he became sort of the archetypal frontier Texan. He was everywhere. He was an Indian fighter. He was a Texas Ranger. He was a scout. He was a mail carrier from San Antonio to El Paso and so forth. As I say, my mother grew up in Bigfoot, which is it's 40 miles south of here, just right off I-35 near Divine. I would go to San Antonio with my brothers in the summer to visit my grandmother. And we would ride the train from Waco to San Antonio. And I remember it was the Katy, the Texas Special. And the train would pull into the station, but it wouldn't stop. And it would go on down to where the stockyards were and then back up into the station. And our aunt and uncle would be there to pick us up to take us on to Bigfoot. My grandmother ran the one and only general store in Bigfoot. And her best friend was the postmistress. The post office was across the street. And people would come in the mornings to pick up their mail, and then they would walk over to her store to have a chaw of tobacco or a Coke or whatever. And her store had this long porch with benches, wooden benches, and they would sit on those benches and tell stories. And I would sit on the edge of the porch with my foot down in the dirt in the little parking lot and listen to those stories. And maybe some of them were about Bigfoot Wallace. I don't know, because Lizzie Thomas, the postmistress, her family took care of Bigfoot in his final days. And so I would listen to those stories even then, and they were fascinating. Whether they were true then, I don't know, but they were interesting.
Joe Holly is a Pulitzer Prize recognized journalist, and he's on the staff at the Houston Chronicle. That's where he writes the Native Texan column. And a selection of the popular columns have been collected into a new book called Native Texan, Stories from Deep in the Heart. It's published by Trinity University Press. That's it for this edition of Texas Matters. Thanks for listening. I'm David Martin Davies. Email us at texasmatters@tpr.org. There are past Texas Matters programs on our website at tpr.org. And you can also find us wherever you get cool podcasts. And tune in again next week for another edition of Texas Matters from Texas Public Radio.